Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Rod Waterworth commenced the discipline of dance in his 20s and subsequently opened a new window to a triumphant career on the stage. For several decades, Rod has been a delightful fixture of commercial musical theatre throughout Australia. His professional theatre credits include Cats, Anything Goes, The Wizard of Oz, 42nd Street, Me and My Girl, Crazy for You, and Fiddler on the Roof. Rod's most recent stage role was singing and dancing the story of Little Orphan Annie, a production he has twice traversed. He continues navigating the roar of the grease paint, attending to his daily post as the congenial stage doorman at the iconic Her Majesty's Theatre in Exhibition Street, Melbourne. Whether stage door or stage centre, Rod is a welcome presence to audience and colleagues alike.
We're on now.
We're on. Oh, good luck, everyone.
People are glued to
their washing machines.
To the podcast platform. Rod Waterworth. Hello.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good, good. I'm glad we're finally sitting down. And we're sitting down. Let's set the scene.
Yes,
we're
please.
At the beautiful Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And in the Mike Walsh suite.
That's right.
VIP suite.
It's a little VIP function room upstairs above the dress circle foyer area. And it's where, if you're lucky enough, you come to drinks at interval on opening nights.
Right.
But they use it for functions and things like that. It's a beautiful art deco. Mike loves his art deco decorations and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's a lovely suite. We're in lovely leather couches.
Beautiful, beautiful. Mike, of course, Mike Walsh, the great impresario,
yes,
of course, who now owns and runs the Maj,
yep,
in Melbourne.
Indeed.
And the producer of Nonsense and Anything Goes.
One of my first shows with Mike, so it's a really...
Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
Oh, right. Mm. Okay, yep. No, he did produce a lot of the shows, yeah, around that time.
And Hayden Productions.
Hayden Productions, mm, yeah, exactly.
Mm. With Sinatra's, I think.
Yep, Sue Farrelly.
Sue Farrelly, sorry.
Yep.
The other Sue. Yeah,
yep,
yeah, yeah, yeah. So perfect place to be having this conversation.
Definitely.
We're at the Maj, of course, you attend stage door.
I do. I've been stage door attendant here for... off and on for coming up to 20 years, which is sort of hard to believe. But the last 10 years mainly on a sort of semi-permanent basis, yeah.
Does it feel like 20 years?
Not at all. But interesting, like knowing that I was going to be chatting to you, you start reflecting and some of it feels like yesterday and some of it does feel like a lifetime ago. Some of the early shows and things like that. But sometimes they're the ones you remember the most.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you miss performing?
I do, but I think it was just a natural progression. I think I started quite late as a performer, so I had very limited sort of training. I think perhaps if I had more training, like perhaps as an actor or a singer, I would have been able to extend. I would have loved to have still been, you know, treading the boards, not kicking the leg, but I do, yeah, I miss it a little bit, yeah. But I think I've moved on, definitely moved on.
But this is the perfect... occupation for you now, because you're still part of it. You're still seeing show folk every day.
Yeah, yeah. I'm mainly here during the sort of admin hours during the day, but you're still Wednesday matinees. You still get to see a few people, and I still get to see a few familiar faces. A lot of the casts and ensemble, particularly, of a whole lot of new faces. You don't see too many ones that were around when I was around, that's for sure. But you know, some of the principal characters and stuff like that. They're people I might have worked with before, and it's great to see them. Always great.
Well, that's true. Every year there's a whole new batch of, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, or the early 20s who've come out of training institutions. Absolutely. And have entered the profession.
Yeah, and they all come out so well-trained. This is the difference from when, you know, perhaps I started, even though I started a bit late, but they all come out so talented and so trained, vocally, acting, dance-wise, and stuff like that. So they come out as a real triple threat.
Yeah.
And the only thing they are lacking is probably experience. And that's what they get. But they come out covering those lead roles, and they're very, very good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a little bit intimidating.
But at the other end of the spectrum, I mean, to maintain, you know, in your 40s, and a generation we are,
yes.
eight times a week when you're kicking your legs up, it's a very intensive, physically demanding occupation, isn't it?
And I think a lot of the productions at the moment, the casts seem to be a little bit smaller, so they have to be more versatile. And that's why, and more energetic, and a lot of them are, a lot of the casts are a lot younger, I think, with a lot of the like productions. But no, they're all pretty amazing. And then throw in, you know, cover calls, and they're not just covering one little character. Often they're covering two or three, you know, roles. They're doing eight shows a week, a couple of full-on cover calls. So it's a hard slog.
Yeah.
And I just watch them, and if they whinge when they come in on a Wednesday matinee, I just go. Smile and get on there.
I don't think I've got the space in my head to cover three roles again. Or
no, I couldn't.
To learn all that dialogue.
I struggle to think of my name in the morning at the moment.
So attending Stage Door during the day, what would that involve?
Stage Door is basically the reception of the venue. So you're getting a lot of the calls, a lot of deliveries come through, like you've got to stock up those bars. A lot of any trade works that get done, it all comes through Stage Door. And these days, security is quite a big thing, so everyone has to sign in. And at Stage Door, when there's a show on, that's where all the cast, crew, orchestra, front of house people, that's where they all sign in and sign out. So, it's a pretty interesting space.
This space, this theatre, has hosted iconic shows over the last century, really.
Yeah.
Do you ever, I'm not asking is there a ghost, but do you, when you're working, do you feel the ghosts of the past, you know, those performers who have graced backstage? And
yeah, look, not so much now. I think when I was still performing, you do, and actually you hear some of the performers come in and they do talk about there is an air to the place, unlike the Prinny. I think they've got a notorious sort of ghost.
Federici,
that's right. But no, we don't have any ghosts down here, not that I know of. But it certainly still has an air about it. It's got such a history. But then how long is that history? Does that history follow on to now, when there's been a whole new generation of performers that don't know a lot about those sort of 80s, 90s, 70s, 80s, 90s shows, the old JCW days and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
it's a different feel.
Now, it's very much the roar of the grease paint, the smell of the crowd. I mean, walking through that Stage Door tonight, it's like stepping back in time.
Yeah.
I mean, just in this suite here, you know, with it, you know, we could be in 1940.
Yeah,
not
absolutely.
Much has changed. It's still very glamorous and still very new.
And I think Mike likes it that way, for sure.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So is there no business like show business? What are we?
Well... Do you want me to break into song?
I don't
think people want to do that. I would say there's no business like show business. But for someone who started quite late, that was never on my agenda, on my mind. It was something that I got into quite late. I was after school, I worked in a bank, I worked in a hospital.
But you, and also as a kid, you were quite sporty. You wanted to be a professional tennis player, didn't you?
Oh, well, singles, doubles, and mixed club champion in 1984, St James Ivanhoe, and then gave it all up. And yeah, it was just never on the agenda. I think it was just nothing that. I learnt the piano when I was younger, and that probably helped me immensely when I did decide to start dancing. So in my mid 20s, that helped with rhythm and musicality and stuff like that. But I just fell into, someone encouraged me to go along to dance classes. I don't know, there was another long story behind that. But
because of fitness or?
I played the piano for my school musical. We did Jesus Christ Superstar and we did the pajama game. And a couple of the dancers in the show taught me the routine to Steam Heat. And I used to always watch the, I was always interested in the in watching the rehearsals. Little did I know that these girls were actually quite good. And a lot of the choreography was some of the original choreography from the movie.
The Fosse.
And then a lady I was playing tennis with, I'm not sure whether you're interested in this story, she was a calisthenics teacher and she wanted something a little bit more theatrical for her senior group. And I said, I know this routine. You could maybe adjust it. Anyway, so I taught her this routine and she said, you could do some dancing. And around that time, it was when there was a lot of variety on TV, like the Channel 9 ballet, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, I promised her that I would go and do a jazz ballet class before she was about to go away on holidays. So I literally looked up the yellow pages and went, A-A-B-B Bartuccio. Oh, that sounds... Oh, I think I know that name. So I was working in Richmond at a hospital and I used to drive down to Bartuccio's in Paran and do my beginner's jazz class. And from there, did one class, did two classes, beginners became intermediate. I'd sometimes go to class and they go, oh, so your teacher's not here tonight because she's in Sydney about to do the Mike Walsh show. And so then I would go home and madly put the video recorder on, and that's, I became obsessed with archiving videos and things like that, which I still do to a certain degree now. And in those days, variety was very big on TV, and I think that's what I sort of wanted to do. But then by the time I did the first ever full-time course at Bartuccio's in 1986, and by the end of that, a lot of the variety had finished. But I think maybe from... Well, in those days, if you went to an audition, you had to get through the dance audition, but if you held a tune and could say a few lines, you got the gig.
Yeah.
A little bit different now.
A little bit different.
But then, yeah, so that's when I sort of got into my first show, which was Cats.
Who was on the faculty at Bartuccio's then?
Tony was there. Caroline Gilmer,
yep,
was Mrs. Bartuccio now, was in charge of the drama. A variety of... we had people like Louis George, Alana Scanlon, Isabel Ryan, infamous tap teacher, which I loved. She had a whole variety of different sort of dance teachers. And I thought, well, I'll give up work. Went on the dole for 12 months. And I thought, well, if I don't give it a go, I'll never know. And I'll probably see one of those people on TV and I'll go, oh, I wish it, if I had done this. And so the big if, that's one of the reasons why I started. And then luckily sort of got some work.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Was there a musical household? Was there any sort of artistic expression? Did you go to the theatre? Or?
Not really. I grew up in a sort of pretty strict Salvation Army family.
Yep.
So the record collection was 99% brass bands, which I'm not a fan of, probably because I was sort of forced to go. And then I remember we had probably The Seekers, the cast album for Sound of Music, and some... the Tabernacle Choir, the American gospel-y type stuff.
Yeah.
So musical family, for sure. My whole parents and my father and brothers all played in the band and all that sort of stuff. I grew up in that as well, but certainly got out of it when I got my first chance. But having played the piano, that sort of helped me with the musicality. Yeah,
I have fond memories of the Salvos at Christmas time. I grew up in a little country town in Victoria, and they would come around every Christmas on the back of a truck and play carols.
Carols, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, for donations,
yep,
and
yep,
all that sort of thing. But that was a very exciting part of Christmas.
Well, it was, and the Salvos in those days, to be honest, like 60s, 70s, they were a force. I mean, they were a big in number, and they had their own... well, apart from, you know, you went to church two or three times on a Sunday, you had the band, you had the choirs, you had youth groups, you had sporting teams. They had a whole netball association at Faulkner Park here on the grass courts, which I was obsessed with a little bit and used to umpire and all that sort of stuff. That's where my obsession with netball began. But they were big in those days. So you didn't really do a lot of stuff outside it.
Yeah.
So I think, and theatre wasn't... Actually, the Selvos had their own musicals.
Yes.
But I never did it.
All right.
I was never involved with it. I had a couple of LPs,
I think, out of curiosity. Yes. There was a Selvos musical.
Yep. No, they had some big musicals. They were all, like, there's some well-known people that was in it, actually. Dean Lotherington.
Right.
Remember Dean? His mother and her and his aunties were like the... I used to say they were like the Andrew sisters of the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
And his mother was the big star of all the big... Gwyneth was the big star of all the musicals.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I didn't get to meet Dean till many years later, because he grew up on the other side of town.
Right.
And all of a sudden, we put two and two together, and then we brought back all the old Salvo memories. It was very funny. Yeah.
I remember as a kid in the 70s, you know, after footy practice or whatever, Dad would call into the pub.
Yeah.
So you'd be there as a cadet with your raspberry, your fire truck. And then one of the Selvos would come through. That was my first sighting of a Salvation Army officer, I think, that would come through.
Selling the war cry?
You're selling the war cry, collecting donations. And I always used to think, what a fantastic costume.
Guys and dolls, there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which I did, actually. I did a production. The one that was here at the Madge, which I think would have been in the early to mid 80s, was just before my time.
Ricky May,
Nancy Hayes,
Peter Adams, Anthony Waller,
Angela Rez. Yeah. Just a few names.
Yeah.
But I did a production of Guys and Dolls for the production company, and they were a bit short of costumes. I ended up wearing my father's proper Salvation Army cap, which they were very proud of.
Yeah.
They thought they'd finally converted me back, but alas, no.
Were they supportive of you going into showbiz?
Yeah, they were. I think, like, you know, I think they were a bit sort of, not amused, but they were a bit, they weren't really sure what was going on. But I was already in my mid-20s, so they weren't going to sort of stop me. It wasn't like I was a young kid saying, you can't do that. And then at the time, like, I got into some pretty big shows. So all of a sudden, I taught them about opening nights and sending flowers. And, you know, one of the first big shows I did was here at Her Majesty's, which was Cats, the original Melbourne Cats in 87, 88, and I'd only been dancing probably less than a couple of years. And so they're coming along to all these opening nights and thought, this is all pretty good. And they were long running shows, so I still had that sort of, they were probably more concerned about the security of the business.
Cats that was never supposed to...
Tour. And I've still got the... the wind cheater that we got made at the end of Melbourne season, which was Cats, it'll never tour, because they were the famous words that Cameron McIntosh said when they were promoting it for Sydney.
Yeah,
so you've got to go to Sydney because it'll never tour.
Which is a great publicity gimmick. I think that was the first show to ever do that.
Yeah.
And then
it lasted 2.5 years up there, and then it came here, we did it for 12 months, and then, of course, it toured
everywhere.
Even in a tent. Yeah.
Which pussy were you?
I was Corica Pat. Which I used to call Shit Kicker Cat. I don't know whether I can say that.
You certainly can.
It was in a brown costume at the back working their ass off.
Right.
But I knew nothing else. I suppose I was always trying to, you know, from starting late, kick higher. I was like flexibility. You know, I was always trying to think I had to work harder to sort of keep up to these people that had been doing it for a long time. So that's all I knew. And so just to come here, put my little brown costume on, and off I'd go. But I was a bit blinkered because I didn't know much about the rest of the theatre, like the crew and all that sort of stuff. I was just focused on what I had to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did it have that original cast come with it? Genevieve was in it, was
it? Genevieve was in it.
David Atkins?
No. Yeah. A lot of them, there was only a handful of people that that had done the 2.5 years. Jeff Phillips, now you're going to test my brain.
Yes,
John
Tugger.
Wood. John Wood was
old Deuteronomy.
Yep. Deb Gary Ginnivan. No, Deb had finished. Deb finished in Sydney, and then Megan Williams.
Yeah.
Came and started Melbourne. Then she left, and Maria Mercedes took over as Grisabella.
Great.
Toby Hackett, original Skimble, was still doing it. And there was a few ensemble that were still there. But that was like going into, you know, year three.
Right.
For a lot of them. Yeah. So, and then I did it for 12 months and then left.
Right.
When they went on to their first Australian tour.
But that was big when it first arrived in Australia.
It was the biggest thing biggest show in the world.
Yeah.
And so I was a bit oblivious to how big it was. Yeah. But that was great. Had a great time.
You went didn't develop any allergies to cats, right?
No, I'm good. I'm good with the...
Was there a litter tray in the wings?
If there was, I didn't see it. Maybe a few of those girls were throwing up. I don't know.
It must have been quite a culture shock to the bank. I mean, the personnel that you're working with. I mean, very extravagant personalities in the theatre.
Well, being in that, like, you know, the ensemble dressing room... with some of those boys that were probably like much younger than me, they've been doing it longer. I shared a dressing room. Next to me in the dressing room was like Todd McKenney. And that's who, like, my first show, I'm sitting next to Todd. We did other shows together later on. But it was, I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest. But I just sort of tried my best. But it was certainly a big culture shock. Yeah. Those sort of personalities you just wouldn't have come across. Because not coming up through those dancing school days or anything like that. So I, you know, had never come across anyone like that. So I thought, I was fascinated. I loved it. And probably got hooked, if I can be honest.
Understandably. But that's the exciting thing, isn't it? When you're in an ensemble dressing room as a young fella, or mid-20s or whatever.
Yeah,
And then, you know, 20 years on, what has happened to those guys or girls that you shared the dressing room with? Todd, for example.
Oh.
I mean, when we did Wizard of Oz, a young fella called Hayden T.
Yes.
Whatever happened to him?
I don't know. It's on Broadway. And I actually I took over from him because he had his knee in Sydney and he left.
Right.
And that's when I joined. When I came in, but with the plan that then I would go on to Melbourne.
Yeah.
But I certainly wasn't a like for like with Hayden T.
Yeah, yeah.
That's for sure.
That's good. Chloe Delamore, you know, whatever happened to her?
I don't know.
You know. But that's exciting, isn't it? When you see those colleagues go on.
And there is a dressing room etiquette. I used to love that sort of dressing room vibe, especially when you got a little bit more experienced. You got your spot in the dressing room. You know, you knew who was doing what. And there was a certain... there's a certain etiquette.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, big personalities which had to be toned down while quiet personalities focused.
Yeah, you got to you know, acknowledge everyone's space.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Was those principles that must get lonely, just sharing with one person or
no? No, that's right. We just go, wow, wouldn't it be great to have your own dressing room?
Mm,
boring.
Mm.
No.
Well, let's trip down the path of various shows that you've done.
Oh, okay, yes, lovely.
I've seen a lot of them, so I would have seen you on stage. One of the most exciting productions I've seen in Australia was 42nd Street.
Yeah,
it was played here at the Madge.
Yep,
of course, did a big tour as well.
Yes.
And it had a huge cast. I mean, that scene, we're in the money. It just, tappers seemed to go on for days.
Come on for ages. The boys, they just keep adding. And I think there was about 22 female ensemble, 16 or so boys. There was that other number, dames, where the girls used to do quick changes. And it just seemed to go on and on and on. But that was incredible. And a lot of the young dancers in that show... but they'd come up through your dancing school days and all that sort of stuff. And I actually learned a lot from them because things like, you know, tied on a Wednesday matinee or a Saturday matinee, and these people that had come through those, you know, tits and teeth sort of dancing school days, they knew how to turn it on. And I actually really learned a lot from that. And it was a great show, show. And I don't know whether, you know, we'd have the cast that big in a show anymore. It would cost a fair bit of money.
Well, exactly. It would be a very expensive show to do.
But people like, Todd was in that, Leonie Page, sensational. But that was when I first sort of, you know, met and got to work with Nancy Hayes, Tony Lamond, who I'm just in love with.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, you didn't sit down in your costume in the wings.
No. No.
There was no talking in the wings. I don't know whether that's all changed now, but, you know, you certainly looked up and you learned from those people. Nancy and Tony were two of my favourites.
And you talk to Nancy and Tony and Jill, Merriman, Geraldine Turner.
Yes.
They talk about those J.C. Williamson's days and how it was a serious occupation. You arrived at the theatre dressed to the nines.
Yes.
And you left dressed to the nines.
That's right. Also. Yeah. And I think, and they had that air about them. And I think, like, you know, they didn't push that sort of old school culture on 21. But I think if anyone was smart, they noticed it. And then they took it away with them in their next shows and things like that. So, yeah. And we had Bill Zappa was the Julian Marsh when I did it. and he was great. And DJ Foster then took over from him as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, great show. And we toured, like, we opened, they'd done the original Sydney production, then they stopped for a break when they thought they were going to Berlin, and then I joined for the Australian tour, which Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide, Auckland, and then we ended up at the Badge for about 6 months or something, which was great. Great time, great show.
The Wizard of Oz we've talked about.
Yes,
you did it twice though, didn't you? You did it with the VSO.
VSO, yep, that's right. So we did it before 42nd Street. That was down at the Arts Centre, and then they did it just for the Melbourne season, like that's the summer musical. Had Pamela Rabe, John Gayden was the wizard. Would have had Tony Gapin in it, I'm sure.
Yes.
And
It was Sally Boyden. Was it Sally Boyden?
No, Tamsin West.
How did I get Sally Boyden out of Tamsin West?
She did Sound of Music.
Yeah, she did too.
Yeah.
She was a young talent.
She was, wasn't she? No, I never worked with her.
No. Tamsin West, yes. Who was... She was in a soapy or something.
Yeah, I think she did... Oh, I can't remember which one. Yeah. I still see a little bit of her, actually. And
Cameron Daddo,
yep. And
David Whitney.
And it wasn't...
Merlin. No, not Merlin. Mervyn Drake.
Yes. Oh, yes. God, you're good.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see all the names. Right. I can see all the pictures. And then we did it for Melbourne. And then 12 months later, we did it again. And that's when Bert joined. We did sort of Brisbane and Adelaide, I think.
Did Patty do that?
Patty did that one.
She was Glinda. Yeah.
Yes.
And then, she came back again 20 years later. With us.
Yes. Did she do it the first time? Now you've got me thinking.
No, it was Nance.
It was Nancy. Yes. Sorry, Nancy. I do apologise.
And then Nancy directed our production 20 years later.
Yes.
Yeah. So it all comes around.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. Times have changed since the Puritans landed on Plymouth Rock.
Yeah.
Anything goes. That was. I saw that three times. Produced by Mike Walsh, starring the great Geraldine Turner and Simon Burke.
Simon Burke, Peter Whitford, Maggie Kirkpatrick, Marina Pryor. Mm. She was still doing ending Les Mis, I think, when she was rehearsing. And I think when we went back and saw Les Mis, I think I saw Les Mis for the first time on Marina's final night. And during Anything Goes rehearsals, the dancers were actually rehearsed at another studio down in Newtown, and the main rehearsal was at the Elizabethan. Is there some place near King's Cross, the Elizabethan Theatre Trust or something? There's a building there. That's where we rehearsed.
Right.
Take my word for it. Mm-hmm. And but then the dancers would rehearse off-site, and then when the numbers were ready, then we sort of then would come and put it into the show. So it became a bit of a, like all the other principals and the singers in the show were going, what have these dancers been doing? And then we'd come and do these big numbers. But I remember doing the vocal call for Blow Gabriel Blow, and Geraldine's just sitting back in her chair, and this voice just pierced through the room, and I went, oh my God. And everyone's like busting a boiler trying to sing out loud.
Yeah.
And she just went through the middle of it. And, incredible. She was amazing in that show.
Yeah.
And, I spent a lot of time with Geraldine. She was fantastic. Yeah.
I saw it in Melbourne. Was it in the State Theatre?
I was at the State Theatre here. Yeah, both times. Yeah.
But it was in the State Theatre in Sydney, originally. Which is a tiny stage. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, there's no wings. You have to sort of plan. You sort of have to time your entrances from around the back. And you usually come, like, hook around. And then all of a sudden you get to the State Theatre and there's, like, wings for days.
Right.
And it probably looked a little bit small compared to the state.
Yeah.
But wonderful production. We did a cast recording.
Yes.
Aria winning, I think.
Yeah.
So I've got my voice on an album.
That's exciting. What did you do Wizard of Oz? Because it would be another one. We recorded that.
Maybe
Nikki Webster's. Did you join it later?
Maybe that was when Hayden T was still in it.
Right.
They needed his voice.
Oh, right.
Okay. No, I didn't know they did a recording of that.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
It was recorded live in front of an audience.
Ah, right.
As Frosty did with The Sound of Music too. Yep.
And we did one for the last production of Annie.
Right.
There was a cast recording. And again, recorded live.
Yeah.
Probably easier than putting everyone in the studio and doing all that sort of stuff.
But, and cheaper.
Much cheaper.
So you're auditioning, of course, all through your career too. Did you enjoy the audition process?
I think, yeah, I did. And I think there was a certain, not a conscious effort, but there was an art to auditioning in those days. You know, I did all those big cattle calls and you got there and it was like boys at 9, girls at 12 or something. Yeah. And you'd go in there and you'd get there early and do your warm up and you learn your routine and you sort of push yourself to the front and then they change lines and I think I used to, and again maybe not so much consciously, but you'd ask a question, you might sort of ask the choreographer, oh, is it this hand or this leg, just to, you know, get yourself noticed. But it wasn't until later that you realised the panel, they're watching you when you walk in the door, they're watching you when you're warming up. If there was a, not that I was great at picking up stuff, but if I'd picked up the routine quite well and someone was struggling, or someone I knew that was more of a singer mover, and I go, come over here and go, just run it through them, I'd give them a bit of a hand, you know, hopefully they might have picked up on a bit of that. They felt sorry for him. He's a nice person, we'll give him a job.
Well, you're hitting on a point there too. I think creatives, producers, whatever, look for somebody who's going to be easy and good to work with and a great company person.
Absolutely.
And, you know, not pissing in your pocket, but you've always been Miss Congeniality.
Well, I think if you've got two people there at the end of the auditions and you go, okay, this one we know,
yeah,
and they're both about the same, well, you're going to go with what you know.
Yeah.
And
Rod's a good company man. He's fun. He's yep. pleasant.
He never and puts he's reliable.
Any, never puts noses out of joint.
No.
Punctual.
No, that's right. Yeah. Doesn't miss many shows.
Yeah.
So yes, that all adds up, and I think that just comes back to that initial sort of work ethic and knowing if you put in the hard work, it sort of pays off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it certainly did, yeah, for me.
Yeah. Can you play an instrument?
Yes. Well, I played piano when I learned piano, but...
So in Jolson, which finishes Act 2 with a big concert.
End of the show, actually.
End of the show,
yeah. Very end of the show. There's about 25-minute concert with Rob coming down as Al Jolson. Yeah, that's the end of the show.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So we had to, in the ensemble, some were like the backing singers, but the majority of them had to have instruments. And that's when I pulled on the old Salvation Army background. And I still knew how to play a valve instrument, brass instrument. There was Rodney Dobson was playing trumpet and a couple other people.
Jonathan Mill tells a funny story. I wonder if you can tell the same one.
Is that when the set was tipping? Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's brilliant. But anyway, they gave me a trombone to play, but I couldn't play the slide trombone, but they bought or hired a valve trombone. So, because I could still play the valve instrument. And so, yeah, I played that for Jolson. So, yes, I don't know whether I could do it now. But yeah, there was that famous time when, because we would be preset on these
bleachers
sort of thing, yeah, like bandstand, and yeah, they would fly in. And there was like, it was like steps. And then all of a sudden these big steps would come down in the middle of it, and Rob Guest would come down, playing the intro to Give My Regards to Broadway. And one of the crew had forgotten to take out a bit of a flat. So the people in front of us, which I think were the saxophones, all of a sudden their bleachers, their bandstand started tipping like a roller coaster ride from Luna Park. We're behind them. I didn't know whether to just keep playing or laugh. They weren't impressed. They felt they were going to die. And then eventually they got down and the show continued. Rob came down, went into the opening number and they went on to it. But all of a sudden there's stage managers in the wings handing glasses of water up because everyone was like panicking and there's people shaking and thinking they were going to die and everything like that. But you know, it was funny. It was a good one. I remember one other time during that, I actually really loved Jolson. I got to do lots of different stuff. We played piano actually on stage in that one as well. We were the song pluggers. So Rob Jolson would be behind a screen and these song pluggers would come in and play their song, and he, just from listening, he would go, yeah, that's a good one, or yeah, I'll sing that one. There was another time when Rob actually bashed his head running around to do a scene change, and we were already on stage starting the number, and then we went into our oohs and ahs, expecting him to come bouncing on stage, and there was no Rob.
Oh.
He was in the wings, and they had to bring St. John's and an ambulance, and he was like, he had wore a wig for the show, and he's going, well, take your wig off, and he's going, no, I'll be fine, because there's no way you're going to stop him. And I'm sure there's probably blood under there at some point, but eventually they brought in the curtain, fixed things up, took it out, and on he went.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. It was incredible. Yeah.
That show is.
Yes, indeed.
That was a show that came from London, but you know, those shows like you're talking about, like Anything Goes, the choreography won a Tony Award.
Yeah.
As did Crazy For You, I think. Susan Stroman's wonderful choreography.
Yeah,
so you're dancing the work of Broadway choreographers.
Absolutely.
Did Stroman come out for Crazy For You? Did you?
She might have. I didn't do the original in Sydney,
right.
So I joined for, they recast it for a lot of the ensemble and a lot of the principals as well, and just did Brisbane and Melbourne, I think it was. She may have come out for the original, but certainly when we learnt it, the Australian dance captain, which I think might have been Aaron Farley, and an English or American dance captain came out and restaged it. But yeah, but it was all the original choreography, and that's a great show. You've got the characters of all the men, different shapes and sizes. Again, Gary Ginnivan, very funny.
Keith Stubley.
Yes.
Yeah. And Warren Kermode, who was...
I think he might have done the Sydney production. Right. Jared Simons, Peter Lowry, you know, all these guys. And then on top of that, you had the leggy showgirls. So you had the glamour, the characters, and all the comedy, and of course, the Gershwin music. So I think out of that's a bit of a favourite when you reflect. Generally, when I was doing shows, whatever I was in at the time was... People say, what was your favourite show? I said, but it was always in whatever I was in at the time. But when you haven't done anything for a while, you can reflect back on some of your favourites. And that was a pretty good one.
Yeah
I loved it.
Yeah, great production. Fiddler on the Roof is interesting because 1 week you're on stage door, the next week you're on stage at the Madge with Fiddler.
That's right, yeah. Which was here. And, I was lucky enough to join that cast and with Topol. And that was interesting. Often, Topol at the beginning of the show, like I played the fiddler on the roof, and even though I was miming the show, miming the playing, but I sort of really concentrated as hard as I could to make it look as authentic as possible. And some of the cast were going, "Oh, gee, it looks like you're actually playing." And I said, "Well, that's the whole idea." And I was pretty much left to my own devices a little bit, but it was interesting because you weren't really the fiddler. Is not part of the ensemble. You can't even technically be seen on stage. The only person can see you is Tevier, because you're his imagination. So my job was to focus. It was actually a really, really interesting challenge, just to focus on him as much as, because at any time he could look up, and I was just focused on him. Whereas the other cast members, I was invisible to them. But there was a time here at the Madge. And often, like, the curtain would go up and I'd go, and I'd start the beginning of the thing, and then Topol would come around and usually get a little bit of a round, and he'd go, "A fiddler on the roof," and he'd go into his opening thing. I must have had a few friends in one time. The curtain goes up before his entrance, so I get the round, and then he comes around and just looks up at me and shakes his head as if to say, "No..." I get the... He said... He as if to say, like, I should be the one getting the round of applause. He thought it was quite funny. Because I got on very well with him, and he's... the energy... I mean, I don't know how old he was when... He did it a couple... He did it once at the Prinny, and then he did the tour that I did. No, the Regent. And when he turned on the energy on stage, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was great. Yeah. Barry Crocker was in that. Tony Gapin, again. Some great people.
Yeah.
Lots of fun.
But you think Topol had done it for several decades, so how many performances?
Oh, yeah.
And the night I saw him, it was as fresh as the day started.
Yep. He liked to wait, he liked to drag it out a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, he'd done it for so long, he knew it back the front. And it was the old, you know, it was the traditional, you know, production, or the original Sammy Bayes, Sammy Dallas Bayes choreography. But I didn't have to do any of the like the Russian dance or the bottle dance or anything like that. I was just over on the side,
fiddling
away.
Now, a couple of times you mentioned the wonderful Gary Ginnivan, may he rest in peace.
Yes.
But he was a wonderful producer of children's entertainment.
Yeah.
And I worked with him many times.
Great.
In his productions, as did you
in
several credits for Gary. Winnie the Pooh, Snugglepot, Cuddle Pie, The Magic Faraway
Tree. Possum Magic.
Yeah.
And of course I did Cats with Gary, and then he was someone that he would go to auditions and I'd be auditioning with him and we'd be like resting on the side while another group, but he'd be casting his children's shows at the auditions for other shows, and he'd come over and go, Rodney, because he always called me Rodney, and do you know that guy over there? What has he got? What's he like? And again, he liked good people working for him. He didn't have the luxury of having understudies or anything like that. But amazing. And he had great quality children's theatre productions. And he was very respected all around the regions, all the civic centres, all in the country towns and stuff.
And really looked after his cast.
He looked after his cast. But this one thing with him, the most important thing for him was paying the people on a Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, he would be, you know, waiting at the bank just to make sure that the performers got paid. That was number one for him.
Yeah.
So, sadly missed. I spent a lot of time with Gary over the years, known him for a long time.
I remember the first time I played Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh.
Right, okay.
Who did you play?
Al. Who?
I remember I did a first performance at the Opera House and I did my makeup and went out, and he came back at intervals and said, "What are you doing? You look like you're doing Kabuki. You're scaring the children."
That's funny. He's got a thing about makeup because he accused me of putting Aboriginal dot painting on my face for my makeup for Al.
Right.
He may have been close, he didn't miss a thing.
One time
I was doing Possum Magic and we had like this little wattle brooch. He swears that I clipped it on one of the ears and wore it as an earring. I don't think I would have done that because I was still quite young and professional, but he doesn't miss a trick. Amazing man.
Or a Faraway Tree.
Yes.
Who did you play?
I played Mother Bear and Father Bear. I played Father Bear one season, then Mother Bear, and then one of the Pixies or something, I think it was. Again, Gary, he said in rehearsing, "I've got a great idea." In the middle of the Three Bears, which is like a bit of a song and dance number, he said, "I've got this great idea. In the middle of the song, you're going to say, stop the music and tell everyone to get it on the other side of the stage. Then I would go over to the wings and grab a tambourine. There you go. Spotlight. Music. Hit it." And I would go in. He put in this whole tambourine solo because he thought it was hysterical. And again, he'd sort of seen me playing around. It probably comes from the old... it was another Salvo trick I learned.
Yeah,
but yeah, he put in this... And I did it as the Father Bear and the Mother Bear. So, he was always trying to find something just to make a little bit of point of interest.
I gave my dame Wash-a-Lot in Faraway Tree.
Oh.
And our Mother Bear was Trevor Ashley.
Oh, yes, yeah. Well, that would have been soft. That would have been very soft.
Yes, that was very soft. That was... Sing out, Louise.
Oh, God, you wouldn't have had to.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, no microphones in any of that, I don't think.
No, we wouldn't have. The production company in Melbourne, which no longer exists, but of course gave a lot of performers a lot of work.
Yeah,
and your credits are extensive with them. Pajama Game, High Society, Baba Birdie, Mac and Mabel, Anything Goes, goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I was lucky. I did the first...
Funny Girl.
Six productions. I did the first six, the first three in the first year, and the first three in the second year. And I wasn't even supposed to do the first one. Someone pulled out, and it was MAME with Rhonda. We actually rehearsed on stage here at the Madge.
All right.
And in those days, you literally learnt the show in a week, and you did a Zitz probe, and then you went down at the Arts Centre. Actually, in the first year, we did it at the Hamer Hall.
Yeah.
Now they rehearse a little bit longer, and the production, or they were...
It was a week. I did How to Succeed in Business.
Yep.
And then you're on.
You're on, yep.
It was only five or six shows,
five or
I
six
think,
shows
in those days.
In those
but
days.
It eventually developed into quite reasonable seasons.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. But the thing was, if you were one of the principals or something, then you knew what you knew your role, you had your script. For the ensemble, you turned up on day one, you didn't know the choreography, you didn't know the harmonies. A lot of the ensemble numbers were a little bit obscure compared to the main numbers of that were known for each of the shows. So it was actually a really tough gig. And, you know, I was very lucky to be involved with them. You know, Ken McKenzie Forbes, Jeannie Pratt, they were very good to me. And I had a great time. A lot of pressure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a great little gig that filled in the gaps.
Do you think it's left a hole in Melbourne's cultural scene?
I think, like, it certainly has left a hole for people. It was a great opportunity for people to get experience.
And to be showcased too, yeah, I suppose.
Absolutely.
In roles that...
And they used to really give... Oh, it was a great opportunity, the way they cast it, a lot of young people. So they that from that side of things, it certainly has missed. It will be missed for sure.
Yeah. A leading lady you worked quite closely with is Ms. Laura Gravity.
Oh, that old thing. I know her vaguely.
You know her vaguely. Laura Gravity, of course, is a drag persona that you developed during your career.
Yep.
How did that all come about?
Oh, again, late starter again. I don't know what this is, what it's all about. I didn't start doing Laura till I was nearly 40. I used to always, in the wings, in shows and things like that, be, you know, dressing up or miming to this just to try to make people laugh. And people always said, oh, you know, you should be a drag queen. And I went, oh, no, that's no. I just do it in the wings of the theatre. I'm not interested in going out in the public. And I met a great group of friends. They used to go to all the gay pubs and clubs and all that sort of stuff. But they used to have these amazing backyard parties. And they used to do drag shows. And I met them, and I was doing shows at the time. So I said, well, like, I'll choreograph them. And we used to rehearse. They were actually some very good quality shows. So we did this one big one, and someone said to me, you should give it a go. And I said, like, oh, look, I'll go down to Commercial Road, which was very big in Paran at the time. There was a competition. I said, you can all come down. I'll go in the heat, and you can all come down for a laugh, and that'll be it. Well, of course, I won the competition. Was still touring a little bit. It wasn't until a couple of years later that I...
Were you singing live?
No, I was just miming. I shouldn't say I'm not a good enough singer, because there's other people that sing live in drag that aren't great. But I think when you've worked with some great singers, I wanted to be of a particular standard. And I was a bit of a baritone. And I reckon if anyone sings in drag, they need to be like, you know, your Disney tenor. That's what I think. It always sounds a bit nicer. So, but I used to love the art of lip syncing. And people used to go, oh, you lip sync really well. And I'll go, well, isn't that your job?
Yeah.
To actually know the words?
Yeah.
And I used to love those camp little cabaret wordy numbers that were a real challenge. But, you know, also loved, you know, Bassie, Caroline O'Connor. I used to do a lot of Australian, you know, performers. Geraldine Turner's Everybody's Fucking But Me was
right.
A big number for Laura in the early days.
Yeah.
And then there's a pub down in St Kilda, the Greyhound Hotel. They were starting a new show and I got asked to do that. And... like I said, like, I might be going back into a show, so I'll give you 3 months. And I did it off and on for probably 12 or 13 years, just down there. And then it wasn't until the end of last year that I actually stopped doing it on a regular basis. At DT's Hotel, I was working with Miss Candy and a couple other people there. But she sadly has passed away also. But to be able to work with her at the end was a real treat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. But... yeah, fun times.
Did you make a decision to stop or just...
I did, yeah. I think, well, I'm full-time at the theatre.
Yeah.
And I just felt like I just didn't have the energy. We're not getting any younger.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have the energy levels to commit to it every Saturday night.
Yeah.
Because that was pretty much what I was doing every Saturday night.
Did you have a sense of grief saying goodbye to...
I think I'm in the process of grieving at the moment.
Right,
because,
right.
Like, I said I was just going to take a break.
Yeah.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
The phone hasn't rung a lot. But then I don't know whether, if it did, do I really want to do it? That's still up in the air.
Right.
But yeah, we'll see how she goes.
Fabulous name. I think it's one of the best drag names I've ever heard.
Thank you very much.
Did you come up with that?
Do you know what? I was driving in the car to one of these backyard parties, and I was listening on the radio, and someone was talking about the law of gravity, and that's sort of where it came from, and it sort of just stuck. Yeah. LG, Life's Good, which used to be a brand name, and so, yeah, that became LG, Life's Good, Law of Gravity. So, and then with a lot of the shows, I from having the theatre experience, and I love being part of a group, love the group numbers, love the choreography, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. It was fun.
I know a lot of performers who still function, they're retired or they don't perform anymore, but they still function on showtime, in that they will sleep all through the morning and then be up until, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah.
How's the effect on your body clock? Do you still have that sort of... Because it effectively is a shift work, really, isn't it? You're working at night.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Do you know what? I think now I'm as pretty much entrenched the Monday to Friday sort of admin hours here, and I'm not much of a night owl anymore. But so it took a while.
You've recalibrated yourself.
Definitely, yeah. Yes. I like the early morning commute on the train and getting here to work. And I'm being part of that sort of hustle and bustle. It's good.
Well, I'm at 5 every morning to get ready for work.
Of course.
And I think it's the best part of the day.
Yeah. It's great. But then what time do you stay up till?
Oh, I'm fading by 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and 10 o'clock. I'm not in bed at 10 o'clock. I can't function.
I'm just nodding on the couch and then early, and then I just sort of wake up and feel terrible.
Do you nod during the day? If I get a chance, I will have a nod.
Absolutely, if I can. I'm surprised I'm still talking, because normally I have a little afternoon nana nap around this time.
You didn't have a siesta?
No, I didn't have time today.
Annie, that was the last time you performed in a big commercial musical,
wasn't it? In a big show. Yeah, and I did that Annie twice. I do love Annie. There's something about Tomorrow. The song Tomorrow, and you know, they say Never Work with Children and animals. And Wizard of Oz, Annie, sure. My whole career, a lot of it. But great show, the last one with Anthony. I did twice with Anthony, but the last production was great. Yeah.
Who were your Hannigans? Because you would have had two different Hannigans.
First time was Amanda Muggleton, and Nancy did the last time with Todd and Chloe as Rooster and Lily.
Well, so Todd's a nice segue. What do you call that? Bookends. Started in Cats with Todd.
Yeah.
And then finishing with it.
Yeah. And we're great mates. He's a Sydney, like, you know, we don't see a lot of each other. But we did plenty of shows along the way. And, you know, we always catch. Like, if I ever saw him, like, we'd be great mates for sure.
Yeah.
There you go.
Great. How was this? Was it as scary as you thought?
I'm sure I don't want to listen to it back.
You'll listen to it back, won't you?
Of course I will. I'll be listening to it immediately.
We've
had a lovely
gin Shiraz.
Yeah, it's a Pimm's Bloody Shiraz gin.
Pimm's?
Four Pillars.
Four Pillars.
There's a plug. Shiraz. Four Pillars Bloody Shiraz gin.
From Her Majesty's.
From Her Majesty's Theatre Bar.
Front of House Bar. Thank you very much. So the next time you're at the Madge, order one.
Get yourself a... Bloody Shiraz gin.
And stand at stage door and wave brave at
Rod. At stage door, whenever you're walking past. Rod. Yeah, Rod, at stage door. Cheers to you. Thanks, Peter.
All that ice. Rod is sheer delight, and any moment in his presence creates utter joy and a guaranteed giggle. And how lovely to record this episode in the iconic Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne, one of the country's great theatrical temples. Join me next time when Stages talks with renowned theatrical designer Richard Roberts, a conversation I also recorded on a recent visit to Melbourne. Thanks for joining us in this episode. You can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by visiting our website, www.stagespodcast.com.au. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time, you know where, on Stages.